So we're looking at the book of Hebrews in our Sunday mornings. And this morning, our passage in Hebrews is the one that I read earlier on, chapter 4, verses 1 to 11. And the opening verse of this passage then contains a striking concept. Now, if you shop at the Sainsbury's down the road there, and if you use the self-service checkout, you find that when you've paid for your goods and you're taking the receipt, in addition to the receipt, the machine also spews out a whole load of other pieces of paper. And often then, one of those pieces of paper will say in bold type something like this, triple nectar points next time you shop. And so if you collect nectar points, then that seems like a great promise. But then as you're walking away, clutching this piece of paper, wondering where you can keep it nice and safe, you suddenly notice amid the small print on that piece of paper, a sentence like this, must be used by, and then there's a date. And the date is about 2 days away. And of course, you've just done some shopping. You're not planning to do any more for another week or something. By which time this wonderful promise of all those nectar points will no longer be valid. Now the opening verse of our passage this morning, it mentions a promise. This promise is from the mouth of God, and it's a promise then about entering his rest. So what is this promise? What is this referring to? Well, it's referring then to a promise that was uttered at a very early point in the Bible. In three passages in the book of Deuteronomy, this promise appears. In chapter 3, verse 20, chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, and chapter 25, verse 19. In each of those passages in Deuteronomy, God promises his people rest. Now, if that promise then of rest for his people, if that were one of those Sainsbury's self-checkout promises, then it would be kind of invalid within a couple of days or something. And yet here is this writer to the Hebrews, and he's writing now hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years after the book of Deuteronomy, and this is what he says, the promise of entering his rest still stands. That ancient pledge of rest for God's people, it's still on the table, the writer is saying. It's still relevant. It's not now obsolete. It hasn't become out of date. That is a live, claimable promise. The promise of entering his rest still stands. And in that connection then, I would like us to notice in this passage this morning three things. And first of all, the evidence. The evidence. Because if you have even just a basic knowledge then of the Bible's storyline, this claim that the writer is making may seem somewhat ridiculous. After all, that promise of entering his rest, what was it? Well, it was a promise of the land of Canaan. I mean, that's quite clear. If you go to those three passages in Deuteronomy, in each of them, the rest is explicitly connected to the land of Canaan. And that promise then was fulfilled. It was fulfilled in a somewhat delayed fashion. We talked about that last week, and the way in which at the point when the children of Israel, when God's people should have received the land of Canaan, they rebelled against God, and so they didn't receive it then, and there was an additional 40 years added on to the waiting process. But nonetheless, eventually they received the land of Canaan. Eventually they went in. Eventually they crossed the Jordan and experienced that great victory over Jericho and all the rest of it. The promise was fulfilled. And so it seems daft, therefore, for this writer to be saying the promise still stands. as a preacher, one of the potential hazards that doesn't keep me awake at night, but which I'm aware of, is kind of making some crass biblical error in a sermon that has the youngest members of the congregation kind of laughing at you and kind of saying over Sunday dinner to their parents, you know, even we know from our story Bibles that it was the Babylonians, not the Assyrians, that conquered Jerusalem, or it was Elisha's servant, not Elijah's servant, that got leprosy, and that kind of thing. It's a danger that I'm aware of kind of just slipping into some crass biblical error, factual mistake. But as this passage unfolds, it becomes clear that that's not what we're dealing with here in verse 1. It's not then that the writer here has made a crass biblical error, that he's just carelessly overlooked the fact that God's people did eventually receive rest in Canaan. No, he has evidence for making this claim. And the evidence then is this psalm which he quoted at length in last week's passage, in the second half of chapter 3, Psalm 95. And that psalm then utters this warning about rebelling against God and consequently failing to enter his rest. That's what you find in Psalm 95. But this is the thing. That warning in Psalm 95, it's not directed at God's people as they're in the desert in the time of Moses on the brink of the land of Canaan. Look at verses 7 and 8 of our passage. The writer says, again, he appoints a certain day today, saying through David so long afterwards, in the words already quoted, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. No, this warning in Psalm 95 about failing to enter God's rest, it's not directed at God's people there in the desert. This is directed at God's people in the time of David, the writer says. Now, by that time, of course, the whole crossing of the Jordan and the fall of Jericho and all that kind of stuff, it's all done and dusted. God's people are now in the land of Canaan. Indeed, never have they looked quite so settled and so established in the land of Canaan as now under the reign of King David. And yet, David is warning them nonetheless, if you harden your hearts, you'll fail to enter God's rest. Therefore, paradoxical as it may seem, at the time of David, God's people must not yet have entered into their rest. Joshua, in leading God's people into Canaan, must not have given them rest. If Psalm 95 is to make any sense at all, then the promise of rest must not have been fulfilled by David's time. And if it hadn't been fulfilled by David's time, there's no reason for thinking that during the intervening millennium between David and Hebrews, it had been fulfilled. And so I'm saying then that Psalm 95 provides the writer with solid, biblical, black and white evidence for this claim that he's making, the promise of entering his rest still stands. So that's the first thing, the evidence. Secondly then, the explanation. The explanation. How then can this be? How can these two things both be true? That on the one hand, Joshua did lead God's people into the land of Canaan, and yet on the other hand, Joshua did not give God's people rest. How can both those things be true? Well, this is the explanation. You see, when those promises in Deuteronomy were made, those promises of rest, those promises weren't coining that term, rest. They weren't inventing that word in biblical terms. Those promises weren't introducing a novel concept into the pages of the scriptures. Rest had already been talked about prior to those promises being made in the book of Deuteronomy. Now, Moses, of course, wrote the book of Deuteronomy, but Moses also wrote all of the first five books. He wrote the book of Genesis. And he first talks about rest back there in Genesis, indeed at a very early point in Genesis chapter 2. And in Genesis chapter 2, then, he has this very striking idea of God resting. In the first couple of verses of Genesis 2, this striking idea of God resting. And having previously written about rest then, there in Genesis 2, when now later on in Deuteronomy, he talks about rest again, and this rest that God is promising his people, then it seems reasonable that he's building on what he'd already talked about earlier on. He's talking about the same rest. So God, in those promises in Deuteronomy, is promising the same kind of rest which he himself had experienced in Genesis 2, a rest that is analogous with that rest. That seems a logical assumption, that the rest in those promises in Deuteronomy is the same sort of rest that Moses has already talked about in Genesis 2. So that means we need to ask the question, well, what was that rest then in Genesis 2, that rest which God experienced? Well, I think it involves a couple of components then. Completion and celebration. So first of all, completion. God had finished something there in Genesis 2. What had he finished? Well, we all know he had finished creating the universe. Perhaps this past week you had some project at work that you were wanting to get finished by the end of Friday. And so you worked hard, and Friday came, and you worked hard through Friday, and you got to the end of Friday, and you'd almost finished it, but you didn't quite finish that project. And at one level then, over this weekend, you are having some rest because you're not actually working on that project right now. But at another level, your mind's on that project still. You're very aware that tomorrow morning you've got to go and put the finishing touches to it. And so you're not resting in that sense that you've completed the thing and you've been able to draw a line underneath it and you've been able to step right back from it. You're not resting in that sense. But you see, on that seventh day of creation week, described there in Genesis 2, God rested in that sense. He had completed this great project he'd been working on for 6 days. And he drew a line under it, and he stepped back from it. And yes, of course, God would still be active. It doesn't mean that God was never going to ever do anything else again. Jesus says, doesn't he, in John 5:17, my Father is working until now. But his activity from that moment on would be a very different kind of activity. He would be doing other things. He had finished, he had completed that thing he'd been doing for those 6 days. And so his rest then, on that seventh day, it involved completion, having finished something. But then, secondly, it involves celebration. Because did you notice that fascinating phrase that appeared in the other passage I read earlier on, Exodus 31? It's part of Moses' legislation about the keeping of the Sabbath. And in verse 17 of Exodus 31, he says of the Sabbath, "It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested." Well, we already know that from Genesis 2. But then he adds another word, and was refreshed. He rested and was refreshed. Now, I don't think he's talking here about a kind of a completely separate thing. He rested, that was one thing, and he was refreshed, that was a separate thing. But the word refreshed kind of adds further definition to the rest. What does it mean? Well, it can't mean then that God was refreshed on that seventh day physically. Of course, that is utterly inapplicable to God. It can't mean that his energy levels needed replenishing. Now, presumably it means that he was refreshed in his spirit, if we may reverently use that language. Emotionally, if we, again, we may reverently use that language. God experienced joy. I think actually once you read Exodus 31 and then you go back to Genesis 2, you notice something that you might otherwise have missed there, that the reference to God resting on the seventh day, it comes immediately after the last verse of Genesis 1, which says God saw everything that he had made and behold, it was very good. And you can sense in that sentence, can't you, this satisfaction, this delight, this joy in God. And that, I think, is supposed to colour the next paragraph about God resting. It was a rest of celebration, of joy, of delight, of satisfaction. So, I'm saying then, that when God promised his people rest in Deuteronomy, he was promising to them a rest like his own rest. And that means then a rest involving completion and celebration. Now this is the thing. They didn't get that in the land of Canaan. That God-like rest, that Genesis 2 type of rest, that rest of completion and celebration, God's people did not get that in the land of Canaan. Think about it. Completion. Think about that from this angle. Think about those momentous, solemn words that God speaks in Genesis 3. You know them so well, having addressed the serpent and then the woman. You remember how God in Eden proceeds to address Adam. He says, Genesis 3:17, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. And so it goes on. It's a solemn description, isn't it, of the human condition post-Eden. This grappling with a recalcitrant creation and working to produce bread by the sweat of one's brow. And God's people had experienced that then prior to Canaan. Was that over once they'd crossed the Jordan into Canaan? All that toil just to get through a day, just to produce enough food to eat, all that sweat, was that now over? Could they step back from that now they'd crossed the Jordan? Well, of course not. They would have to still toil day in, day out, work by the sweat of their brow in Canaan, just as they had done out of Canaan. There was no completion in that deep sense in Canaan. Or what about celebration? Well, of course, once they were in the land of Canaan, the law of Moses really kicked in, didn't it, and shaped their lives. And the law of Moses then, it provided times of celebration. Those three great annual festivals, they were times of celebration. The monthly new moon, it was a time of celebration, and most especially the weekly Sabbath. it was a time of celebration. We have read this morning and sung this morning from Psalm 92. And Psalm 92 wonderfully illustrates that. It's entitled A Song for the Sabbath. And it's a celebratory, festive kind of song. We sing for joy at the work of your hands. That's the tone of Psalm 92. Think of Leviticus 23, verse 2, where the Sabbath is referred to as a holy convocation. Not a word that we're particularly familiar with. Convention is a justifiable translation there. We're familiar with that, and the summer's coming, and there'll be the Keswick Convention. It's a time then when God's people come together and celebrate the gospel, celebrate the Lord Jesus Christ. And the weekly Sabbath then was a time of celebration, but of course it always ended. And however much it was enjoyed, you always got to the end of it. And there was always going to be a next day when it was back to normal and the celebration was over. And so you see what I mean then. That this rest that God had promised to his people, it was much more than the land of Canaan could ever possibly deliver. Now, that's not to say that the land of Canaan was irrelevant, that it was some kind of red herring or something. No, I said earlier that those passages in Deuteronomy, they explicitly connect the rest with the land of Canaan. That's absolutely true. But that's because the land of Canaan functioned, if you like, as a little visual aid for God's people. Throughout the Old Testament, God gave his people lots of visual aids, didn't he? A type is the fancy technical term that you'll find in theological books. A picture, a visual aid. Because in a superficial sense, then, the land of Canaan did provide some rest for God's people. It gave them some kind of establishment, some kind of fixedness and settledness. They were no longer this vulnerable nomadic tribe. So it did give them some superficial rest, and to that extent, then it was a faint picture of the real rest which God had been promising to them. But it wasn't the real rest. It wasn't the state of completion and celebration which God really intended for his people, because that awaits what the writer has called earlier on in chapter 2, verse 5, the world to come. It's in that world to come, that future world, that future age, that new order, at the end of this one, it's there that the true rest, which God was really promising all along, will transpire. That comes out very clearly in verses 9 and 10 of our passage. Verse 9, so then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. So that's referring to the celebration aspect that I mentioned. In other words, in that world to come, the celebration, which in Canaan was limited to a weekly Sabbath and a few other festivals dotted around the year, in the world to come, that celebration will be total and pervasive. The whole thing will be one big Sabbath rest. Feasting and laughing and celebrating in the presence of God's people and in the presence of God himself. Then verse 10, for whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. And that's referring then to the completion aspect that I talked about. In other words, in that world to come, all that working by the sweat of our brows which has dominated human existence from Eden onwards, including in Canaan, that will be over. A line will be drawn under all that toiling, all that hard work, that laborious work that has dominated human existence throughout this age. Now, as we said, with God, it doesn't mean that God's people will no longer do anything, that throughout eternity they'll just be inactive and idle. No, they'll do new work but work that isn't about the sweat of the brow and toiling and survival, but work that is about human flourishing and fulfilling the design that God had for us in the beginning. So there's a world to come for the people of God. A world of rest, in this sense, completion and celebration. And until that world to come transpires, the words of verse 1 are true and accurate. The promise of entering his rest still stands. Just a couple of quick points there before we move on to our third heading. One is that I think it can actually be inferred from this passage that there's still a place in the life of God's people for the weekly Sabbath rest. Those who argue against that will say to us, the Sabbath in the Old Testament, it pointed forward to the rest that Jesus gives for our souls through the gospel. And now Jesus has come and he's given us that rest for our souls through the gospel, and so we don't need the pointer anymore. We can dispense with the symbol. But according to this passage, the Sabbath pointed actually to that eternal rest that's going to be experienced in the world to come. And that hasn't transpired yet. That's still future. And so there's no reason then to dispense with the symbol. And yes, as I mentioned in my prayer earlier on, it's now in these new covenant days modified, certainly. The day has changed. The name, you could say, has changed, if you like. Lord's Day. Other aspects of it, I think, are different. But the essence, the kernel is the same. A weekly day of rest pointing us forward to the great rest that awaits in the world to come. And then just the other thing here, I think there's probably a particular significance in the writer mentioning in verse 8 Joshua. As some of you will know, Joshua and Jesus have the same name. Joshua and Jesus, it's the same name. One is Hebrew, the other is Greek. And I think verse 8 then may just be a gentle, subtle reminder that God's promised rest always comes through a Joshua. The type, the picture, the visual aid, it came through one Joshua. And the real thing, the eternal rest, it comes through another Joshua, through Jesus, through his work, his death and resurrection. It's those who trust in him who are being led to that coming rest. Does that apply to you this morning? Do you belong to the ultimate Joshua, to Jesus Christ? Are you clinging to him and being led by him into that rest that is one day coming? So we're talking then about this claim in verse 1, the promise of entering his rest still stands. And we've noticed the evidence, and we've noticed the explanation. But then, finally, let's notice the effect. The effect. If this is true then, if the promise of entering his rest still stands, what effect should that have on us? On us as Christians. This is a letter that is written to Christian people. What effect should this have on us? Well, really here we're returning to the same terrain that we were in last week. And you remember how in last week's passage then, in chapter 3 there, the great emphasis was don't fall away from the living God. And don't fall away from the living God as the Israelites there in the desert fell away from the living God. And really, our passage today is saying the same thing, but it's a fuller picture now. It's not simply don't fall away from the living God as the Israelites did, but don't fall away from the living God and fail to enter God's rest as the Israelites did. As they failed to enter the type, the visual aid, make sure you don't fail to enter the real thing. But we can break that down into some details. What does that involve then? This making sure that as God's people, we do enter finally the rest that is promised us. What does that actually involve? Three things quickly. First of all, fear. Fear. Verse 1. Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. Striking choice of word, isn't it? And we need to be careful then. The writer isn't suggesting that as Christians we should kind of be gripped by this paralyzing fear that we're not going to make it into the promised rest. That we should kind of be dominated by unease and anxiety about this. No, it's quite clear, isn't it, from the New Testament as a whole, that the norm for God's people is being perfectly assured that we are one day going to receive that rest. That's the norm. And so the writer here isn't saying live dominated by fear. I think the point is something like this. What is a terrifying thought to you? That's perhaps the question the writer is encouraging to ask. What is a terrifying thought to you? I mean, all sorts of things are terrifying thoughts to us, aren't they? I mentioned earlier on that concern about making some crass factual error. I quite often dream at night, especially on a Saturday night, that I'm standing in a pulpit and I can't think of anything to say. Some of you might wish I could think of a bit less to say sometimes, but that's what this dream I have. And I guess it depends then what we're into. If you're into sports, this is the thing that terrifies you. Might be missing a penalty at a crucial point in the game. If it's music, singing, it's kind of getting some song completely out of tune and messing it up. If it's hospitality, kind of finding that the meal's not been cooked properly and you've given all your guests food poisoning. Or it might be that it's the fear of arriving at work and realizing you've forgotten to put your trousers on, or it could be anything. And what is then the thing that terrifies us? Well, I suppose the point is that whatever that thing is, we compensate, don't we? And we jolly well make sure that that thing doesn't happen. And so I try and make sure I do plenty of preparation to preach so that I will have something to say. And the singer does the preparations necessary so that they won't mess up that song. The sportsman, so that they won't miss the penalty, and so on. We compensate for that thing that truly terrifies us. And I think what the writer is saying then is that as Christians, the thing, the ultimate nightmare for us, should be missing out on that eternal rest. But not then, as I say, in a way that paralyzes us and dominates us, but in a way that makes us compensate, if you like, that makes us diligent and rigorous and disciplined in our Christian life so that we won't miss out on that rest. That's the point the writer is making. We need to fear above everything else, above being embarrassed before our colleagues, above having no money in the bank, above everything in our health and our circumstances collapsing. We need to fear above everything else, fear missing out on that eternal rest. And fearing that then, let's make sure that we are diligent in pursuing that eternal rest. So it involves fear, but then secondly, it involves faith. It involves faith. Verse 2, for good news came to us just as to them, that's the people in the wilderness, but the message they heard did not benefit them because they were not united by faith with those who listened. Slightly odd expression. I think what that means is that most of the Israelites did not have a common faith with those who listened and did believe. Because we said last week there were at least two persons, weren't there, that did believe. That's Joshua and Caleb. But the problem is that the rest of the Israelites, they weren't united by faith with those who listened and believed. They lacked faith. They were unbelieving, most of the Israelites. And we'll talk about this more as we continue in Hebrews, but this writer does talk about faith in quite a distinctive way. You know how often in Paul's letters, the object of faith is Jesus Christ. And so it's trusting in Christ for salvation rather than trusting in works, trusting in me and my efforts. It's just leaning helplessly on Jesus. In Hebrews, the object of faith is not Jesus generally, it's God's promises. And particularly then God's promises concerning this future rest. And that's the point here then. And the point is then that if we are going to enter that rest, yes, we need to fear, missing out on it above any other fear in our lives. But we also then need to make sure that we are trusting, that we are believing in God's promise about that future rest. Now that may seem a very simple thing. Oh yes, I'm believing in God's promise about the future rest. But what did it mean for the Israelites to be unbelieving? They had this promise from God, the land of Canaan. Remember the level of the type, the visual aid. The land of Canaan, there's this rest for you there. They had that promise. What did it mean that they didn't have faith, as this verse says? Well, it means this, doesn't it? It means they concluded that the rest that God was promising them in Canaan was not the best rest for them. That's what it means. They concluded the rest that God was promising in Canaan was not the best rest for them. Because Canaan had giants in it. That's what the spies had reported. Canaan had these scary monsters in it. And so they decided they were going to go back to Egypt. Because Egypt was okay, really. I mean, it wasn't that bad. And so they decided that the rest that God was promising, that wasn't the best rest. They would get a better rest back in Egypt. That's what their unbelief consisted in. And still for us then, the unbelief that I'm talking about this morning, that we as Christians could fall into, is this unbelief. Deciding that the rest that God has promised, it's not the best rest for me. Now you might say, well, I would never arrive at that decision. I would never conclude that. But we need to look at our lives. And if, in fact, my life today is consumed by ambition to make as much money as I can and live in the best house that I can and be as successful as I can in this world, then am I not saying, in fact, by that, that the rest God has promised, which lies in the future, that's not the best rest for me. I'm going to find my rest here. I'm going to find my rest by having everything I can get my hands on in this world. It's challenging, isn't it? We can say, oh yes, we're believing in that rest to come. We're believing in the promise. But does it look like that? The shape of our lives today? Or does it look like the Israelites, we're going somewhere else for our rest. We're going to the shopping mall for our rest. We're going to sex, entertainment, whatever it might be, for our rest. Fear, faith, and then the third thing it involves, fighting. Fighting. Verse 11, let us therefore strive to enter that rest. That's a strong word. And such a stark juxtaposition, isn't it? Strive to enter rest. The rest is to come, it's not now. And until the rest comes, we'll have to strive if we're going to get there. He'll talk later on in chapter 12, verse 3, verse 4, to refer to your struggle against sin. Struggle, your battle. Your fight against sin. And the sin then in view is the sin of apostatizing, of turning away from Jesus Christ. In their case, They were tempted, we've said so many times already, they were tempted to go to an Old Testament form of worship with the temple and priests and all that kind of stuff. And the writer's saying you have to fight that, you have to strive against that temptation. It's attractive, it's alluring, it's seductive. If you go down that route, you'll avoid persecution and you'll be accepted by your fellow Jews, and it's very attractive, but you need to fight against it and struggle if you're going to enter the rest. And we will be faced at every turn throughout our lives with temptations to turn away from Jesus Christ. It's as simple as that. And if we're going to enter God's rest, it's not going to be an easy ride. It's not going to be a stroll in the park. It's going to be a fight, a striving, a struggle. Perhaps you're not a Christian this morning. And I'm not going to say to you, become a Christian because then life will be easy. That would be lying. The battle will begin then when you become a Christian. But it's worth it, because at the end of the battle is this rest, this perfect rest, this world of rest. But those of us who are Christians this morning, let's resolve then to make our biggest fear missing out on God's rest. Let's resolve to believe the promises and look for our rest there in what God has promised, not here. And let's fight and strive so that we shall enter God's rest. Amen. We're going to conclude singing 764, which takes up that